The major oil companies love to advertise their investment in alternative energy sources. Here's a TV spot from BP, the company formerly known as British Petroleum, now Beyond Petroleum.
I think it would be in their best interest to continue to pursue things like solar energy.
I think biofuels are a viable alternative.
Any business person that is worth their salt is going to diversify as much as they can.
We wondered how much these companies are actually spending on green energy. So we called Beth Evans, managing editor of Platts Oilgram News. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So how much are these companies spending on green energy sources?
The numbers that we constantly see are in the millions of dollars. It's sort of a drop in the bucket compared to the billions of dollars they make still dealing with petroleum.
Can those millions of dollars have a significant impact?
Well, yes and no. Some of the companies are investing their millions in technologies that if they develop a new science that can then be patented, they will hit the jackpot. They'll make billions of dollars. But right now, they're just putting millions here, millions there, doing a lot of advertising that they're putting these millions in. But again, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what they do with petroleum still.
Do you see a difference in approach from one company to another, or are they all doing pretty much the same thing?
Well, I guess it all started with BP and its Beyond Petroleum advertising campaign. They were out in front, and you're seeing more and more the other companies gathering steam and putting more advertising out there. For instance, in one of the local papers here in New York, I saw a big ad by ExxonMobil talking about one of their new technologies they're working on.
Well, why is ExxonMobil, this conservative company, doing this?
Well, I think the analysts would tell you that it's good public relations. When gasoline prices are as high as they are and people are looking for someone to blame, they're going to turn straight to big oil. And if big oil, quote unquote, can say, hey, it's not me, I'm trying to help you by investing in alternatives, then that's better for them and better for their stock.
When you look at the investments that these companies have made, do you see productive things coming out of that?
There could be. BP and DuPont got together, and they're taking a look at creating something called biobutanol. Think of it as ethanol, only it can move through pipelines, which the ethanol here in the States cannot move through. It has a higher energy level. So if they can develop something like that, then that's better for everybody.
But I take it there are also examples of oil companies investing money that is not quite enough to push the alternative energy source to the next level.
Sure. Chevron invested in something called Galveston Bay Biodiesel a while back, but the company Galveston Bay has actually sued Chevron now, saying that Chevron won't put up the money to fund further expansion of their plant.
What's the moral of the story there? What does that indicate?
Well, that indicates that the big oil companies are looking at alternative fuels as yet another investment, like any investor looks at them. If you look at the share prices of some of the ethanol and the biodiesel companies right now, they are way down. So the fact that the majors aren't necessarily investing a lot right now in those companies, maybe it's just a question of good or bad business.
Beth Evans is managing editor of Platts Oilgram News. Good to talk with you.
Thanks a lot, Ari.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. On Wall Street, this was the kind of day that stock traders would probably like to forget. The Dow Industrials lost more than 350 points, that's about 3% of their value, to close at its lowest level in more than a year and a half. Among the big losers was General Motors, which fell to a low that the company hasn't seen in 50 years. There was bad news just about everywhere you looked. NPR's Jim Zeroli joins me now. And Jim, before we get to the stock market, first, something related, I want you to tell us what happened with oil today.
Well, it doesn't take very much to send oil prices up these days. They just keep climbing. What appears to have been the cause today were some remarks from the president of OPEC. He basically said that oil prices could go to anywhere from $150 to $170 a barrel this summer. When somebody like that in a position like that says something like that, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy because investors rush in and start buying up futures contracts. Prices go up. Also, Libya is making some noises about cutting oil production. So oil rose about $5 a barrel, and that was really one of the big factors affecting stocks today.
Well, now that 3% drop in the Dow, was the sell-off in the stock market very broad-based. Did the other indices go down that much?
Oh, yeah. This was a meltdown. Every one of the 30 stocks in the Dow lost ground. The Dow is now down nearly 19% off its high in October 2006. You had the Standard & Poor's 500 index falling below 1,300. That's considered an important milestone for stock traders. You know, yesterday, the Federal Reserve issued a statement saying that the downside risks to the economy have diminished. In other words, you know, things don't look as bad as they were. But once again, the stock market is sort of going off in a different direction. There's still a lot of anxiety that resurfaces on a regular basis, and it did so today.
Well, but if the market isn't responding to the Fed, that would be presumably a jump up if they responded to the Fed. What are the reasons for this decline?
Well, a lot of it is just, you know, the same old stuff we've seen. Oil prices going up, a dollar falling. You had more troubles in the financial sector today. You had an analyst coming out and saying that Citigroup and Merrill Lynch are likely to face bigger losses than people thought in the second quarter. We're really just a year into this credit crisis, and we're still trying to figure out the real impact of the subprime mortgage crisis on banks. And then finally, General Motors got downgraded, as you noted. Mm-hmm. All of the U.S. companies are getting battered by gasoline costs. Today, you had an analyst saying that General Motors might have to cut its dividends. Shareholders don't really need another reason to run away from General Motors, but I think they found one today.
Jim, are there any signs that the economy might be beginning to turn around and this could be the bottom of the problem?
You know, we had a revision on the first quarter economic growth numbers today. There were some positive signs. Exports are up a lot because of the weak dollar. There are also some omens. You had two major technology companies, Oracle and Research in Motion, both saying their profits weren't going to grow as fast as they expected. You had a truck company, Oshkosh, saying their sales to Western Europe are lower than expected. And, you know, we're hearing some rumblings that the European economy is slowing. That's obviously a big market for U.S. goods. And if that happens, that's another potential problem facing us.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Jim Zeroli in New York. California continues to push ahead with its ambitious plan to cut greenhouse gas emissions, that despite federal resistance on the issue. Back in 2006, the state passed a groundbreaking law called the Climate Change Solutions Act. It mandated that the state cut emissions back to 1990 levels by 2020. Well, today, California air regulators released a draft roadmap of how they plan to do just that. Tamara Keith of member station KQED reports.
Most of the reductions, 80%, will come through regulations and policies aimed at increasing the efficiency of everything from appliances to cars, houses, and factories. Here's how UC Davis professor and Air Resources board member Dan Sperling describes it.
We're going to make the vehicles more efficient, make the air conditioners better. We're going to, you know, have more efficient appliances, more efficient buildings. We're basically just talking about doing things a little better.
Large gains are expected from a limit on tailpipe emissions from cars. It's already in state law, but so far the Federal Environmental Protection Agency has prevented California from enforcing the rule. The plan also calls for utilities to get a third of their electricity from renewable sources. A bill mandating that is working its way through the legislature, but is by no means guaranteed to pass. Still, this blueprint is a critical first step, says Audrey Chang of the Natural Resources Defense Council.
This is a great start for California, and it's more important than ever before for California to be really moving full speed ahead on global warming. And we really can't afford to wait for solutions to be coming from Washington.
The remainder of emissions reductions, about 20%, will come through what's known as a cap-and-trade system. Emissions reductions achieved by one company could be sold to another one to meet their cap. Over the coming years, California will work with other Western states and three Canadian provinces to develop this cap-and-trade system. It could become the nation's most broad-based carbon trading system. This aspect of the plan pleases the business community. Shelley Sullivan represents a coalition of California companies.
The board has recognized the importance of a market system and a cap-and-trade system that will ultimately reduce costs for California consumers. And we're also very encouraged by the fact that the board wants to link to other regional and potential federal and ultimate global programs.
There are concerns about how much this carbon policy will cost the state. Mary Nichols is chairman of the Air Resources Board, in charge of implementing California's Climate Change Prevention Act. She says California's green economy will bloom, outweighing other costs.
At this point, what we're talking about is people investing in our economy and creating new jobs. I think there's a fear factor about change, but look at what we're talking about in this plan. Everything that's in the plan is in the nature of making our economy more sustainable, more efficient.
And perhaps more important than the emissions reductions themselves is the example California could set, says Jim Bushnell with the University of California Energy Institute.
What we need is for this to be mirrored and copied by a whole lot of other places.
The California Air Resources Board will continue refining the plan throughout the summer. State law requires that it be completed by the end of the year. For NPR News, I'm Tamara Keith in Sacramento.
Two Bear Stearns hedge fund managers last week became the first Wall Street executives to face criminal charges in the subprime mortgage crisis. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston reports that emails at the center of the case may be less damning than prosecutors say.
The media blitz around the Bear Stearns arrest was ferocious. Their perp walk was on all the cable news shows.
Two former managers for Bear Stearns faced charges they duped their investors.
The arrest blanketed the airwaves. The Justice Department held two press conferences about them, one in New York and one in Washington. Officials read excerpts of emails cited in the indictment. They accused fund managers Ralph Chiaffi and Matthew Tanin of fraud. In emails to each other, the two worried about the possible collapse of the subprime mortgage market, while at the same time they assured investors all was well. Brad Simon is a former prosecutor at the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York. Now he represents white-collar defendants.
As a defense attorney, I would look at these emails and try to persuade a jury that they don't show an intent to defraud. They show other things, panic, hand-wringing, you know, what do we do now, as opposed to, oh, let's go out and deceive investors.
NPR contacted half a dozen hedge fund managers to gauge whether the emails excerpted in the indictment went beyond the pale. They said internal emails are often emotional. One day a hedge fund manager might think he's doomed. In one email, Tanin said the funds were toast, only to be buoyed by some unexpected opportunity the next. People close to the case say that when full emails come out, they will present a very different picture from the one the government has painted. Again, Brad Simon.
If the government is cherry-picking selected email, that's a powerful argument for the defense. Well, what about these emails? How come these are not in the indictment? Well, if that's the case, then it could be a very different situation.
Former prosecutor and now defense attorney Michael Bochner agrees.
I think a careful review of the emails, and certainly in conversations I've had with defense counsel about the entirety of these emails and activity that's not reported in the indictment, leads me to believe that this case is not nearly as strong as the government would lead everyone to believe that it is.
The FBI has said it is investigating at least 19 major Wall Street firms involved in the subprime mortgage crisis. Bochner says the fact that they started with Bear Stearns isn't a surprise.
Bear Stearns was essentially a safe bet.
Had they rolled out surprise indictments against some other Wall Street company now, it might well have resurrected fears that the mortgage crisis was far from over. Bear Stearns is out of business.
They seem like a fairly easy target. There's not going to be a huge ripple effect on the market by looking at the activities of another firm like Bear Stearns. And it was, in a lot of ways, a fairly safe target.
NPR has learned from two sources close to the case that the fact that Bear Stearns no longer existed played a big part, though certainly not the only part, in prosecutors' decision to indict Chiaffi and Tanin. The U.S. Attorney's Office and FBI declined to comment on the case. Michael Bochner.
Sometimes this is an effort to rattle cages and get people to come in and corroborate the government's case, give them information about other types of matters. So I'm not so sure they necessarily brought their strongest case first.
All these emails and witnesses are trying to get to the bottom of one thing. Did Chiaffi and Tanin intend to mislead investors? What would happen if Chiaffi was just caught on the wrong side of a trade and panicked? Stanley Arkin is a prominent Wall Street attorney.
How do you punish bad judgment when it's not malignant intent? And I'm assuming that what happened, in some respects humanly, was that his judgment failed him. His fear of failure came over him. And probably greed as well.
A jury will have to decide whether that is criminal. Clearly, last week's arrests were meant to send a message. People on both sides of the case say there was intense pressure from Washington to have a high-visibility Wall Street arrest coincide with a lower-level mortgage fraud crackdown announcement last week. And it worked out that way. Hours after Chiaffi and Tanin had their perp walk, the Justice Department announced that it had arrested 406 real estate professionals for mortgage fraud. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News.